Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Filling in for Rick today, and we've got a pretty good show lined up for you this morning, I think. In the next hour, Gary DeCarolis of Burlington History Tours. He is quite a student of the history of the biggest city in Vermont.
And that sound a little better there, Danny? All right, good. And you can find out what Gary's up to at burlingtonhistorytours.com. And we're going to be talking about the history of Burlington. That's in the next hour here on WDEV FM and AM. But we begin today. We're going to head to the legislature and find out the business perspective on what's going on under the Golden Dome virtually as we welcome in Charles Martin. He is the Vermont Chamber of Commerce Government Affairs Director, and he joins us right now on Vermont Viewpoint. Charles, appreciate you being part of the show today. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me on.
Out of the folks at the Vermont Chamber, I was looking at the government affairs team, and there's about four people you have there. Who's doing most of the lobbying with the lawmakers?
Well, I think the team kind of divides it up. I'm sort of the generalist on the staff that helps the two vice presidents that you've seen on our staff list, Amy Spear and Chris Kerrigan, do their work. And then, of course, our chamber president, Betsy Bishop, does her fair share of lobbying as well. Chris Kerrigan focuses more on manufacturing. Amy Spear focuses more on tourism and hospitality industry support. Betsy works a little bit in all of the different kind of advocacy spaces. And then, I'm sort of a staff generalist.
So how's the lobbying going in a remote session?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's good and bad things. I would say in some ways, the legislature, as far as the actual formal meetings, has become more transparent than they've been in past years, in the sense that everything is now recorded and stored on YouTube forever. And prior to the pandemic and kind of kicking off in March of last year, if you wanted to know what had occurred in committee proceedings in the Vermont State House, you'd have to order an audio file from the State House, and it's a pretty cumbersome process. So in that sense, I think it's an improvement, just as far as the record-keeping goes. But from an advocacy sense and the ability to actually weigh in, you can't replace having the State House be open, and I'm just speaking from my own perspective, and my ability to approach a legislator after a committee proceeding in the hallway or the cafeteria of the State House to chat with them about whatever had transpired prior. Now that needs to be a formal call or a formal email exchange. So I would just say the communication and the ability to communicate with legislators has definitely diminished as a result of the pandemic.
Are you saying that lawmakers, if you're at the State House, you can spot them in the cafeteria or kind of stake them out and track them down? Is it a little bit more difficult to get the ear of a lawmaker remotely?
It is, and to be completely frank, it's a little more awkward because I like to have personal relationships with the folks that represent us in the state, and I like to have a human relationship with them as well. And, now it's kind of like I can't just kind of call them up to chit-chat about how their day went. When I call legislators, it's usually because it's for a very formal matter. And I do kind of miss the more kind of human aspect of developing those relationships. So it is a bit of a challenge. But I think, our team has adjusted very well to it. And I think we're managing it the best we can and still doing our best to advocate for Vermont businesses.
Are some lawmakers taking advantage of the situation to kind of defer you to communicate with them through email and more of an indirect method of communication?
I would say for me personally, and I'm not speaking for all advocates in the state house. I haven't had a particularly difficult time reaching lawmakers. If I did try to contact them by phone, or via email even. I think in some instances what I'm seeing is proposals being generated and kind of advanced a little more expeditiously with a little bit less input than they had in past years when we were in the in-person operation.
We're talking with Charles Martin. He is the Government Affairs Director with the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. You're invited to join us in on the conversation this morning. It's 802-244-1777 and toll-free at 877-291-8255. I see the Vermont Chamber of Commerce has been talking about a piece of legislation particularly called S-10, and I also... There was an editorial in VT Digger that came out over the past day or two from Sean Schuldeis, the state director of the National Federation of Independent Business, and Richard Wabi, the executive vice president of the Associated General Contractors of Vermont, two other sort of lobbying arms. Do you consider them to be allies, colleagues, competitors, combatants? What's your relationship with these other groups?
We generally work pretty closely with those groups. Oftentimes, our interests are aligned. You know, I'll add that 7 Days and VT Digger also ran pieces today on S-10. But this is an issue that more or less should concern anyone who employs anybody in the state of Vermont. So I think that's kind of why it's getting the wide reach that it is.
And according to what Wabi and Schuldeis included in their letter, initially there was an effort to get the legislation to hold harmless small businesses for the results of the pandemic. And now what has developed out of this bill is an alarming increase in tax liability. Is that right?
Yeah, so the bill, that's correct. The bill was originally born out of a proposal by the Scott administration that kind of identified the fact that businesses, typically their unemployment insurance rates will increase if they lay off employees. And like any insurance, you know, if you're assessed to be a higher risk factor, then they have to adjust for that in the fund. And in normal years, that would be for reasons that were, you know, the employer's doing alone. The difference last year was that the majority of layoffs were the direct result of government mandates related to safety concerns. So the Scott administration proposed to the legislature that we adjust the rate at which the fund is replenished to give employers a little bit of short-term liquidity in the near term so they can stay open, stay operational, keep the folks who are working for them employed now, and then hopefully reemerge from this pandemic successfully, and then pay into the fund to kind of make it whole in the out years when the business community is in a more stable position. So it's by no means, you know, and I wanted to spell something that's kind of been a mischaracterization. It's by no means a proposal for a gift. It's just a deferral of payment, if you will.
Well, this bill, S-10, that has made it out of the Senate Economic Development Committee, intends to increase unemployment benefits by 20%. Now, a 20% pay raise is very hard to find for working people. For people who are not working, it sounds even more onerous, I guess I would say. That's quite a shocking development. I'm sure a lot of the folks in the business community were taken aback by what they discovered when the details of this bill came out.
Yeah, and you know the principal concern, obviously the financial aspect. This whole proposal's been assessed to probably cost somewhere in the realm of $50 million, which is sort of daunting for employers right now, given the financial state that they're in. But I think more importantly is the federal government just passed a host of benefits for workers, including a $300 a week unemployment insurance benefit increase. So the concern that we have at the Vermont Chamber, or at least our principal concern, is that if you couple S-10, if it were to advance, with that federal benefits increase, there will be a large portion of Vermont's workforce who will have very little incentive to go back to work. And I don't say that in a disparaging way. It's just logical financial behavior to pursue the most lucrative option. And if this bill advances, a large portion of the workforce, most lucrative option will be to stay right at home on unemployment, which will inevitably delay the economic recovery that we're all excited for this summer and fall.
Is it possible, or do you consider the framework of this bill and the general benefits that are arranged by the state of Vermont as an incentive for somebody who is currently working to find an incentive to not work and collect the benefits?
I'm not sure that folks are going to drop off of employment. And, you know, if they did at this point, if someone voluntarily separated, they'd have to kind of make a compelling case that that was related to COVID-19 safety concerns, out of concerns for themselves related to the pandemic. I think what we're most concerned about is this kind of pool of the workforce that is, you know, rightfully so, at home receiving benefits right now because of the state of the economy. We're concerned that they will not have incentive to return to work. And employers are eager to continue to provide their workers, you know, reliable incomes and benefits and hire them back on and start moving forward and emerge from this pandemic. But this bill really will make that considerably more difficult if it passes as written.
Let me ask a question. I should probably know this, but part of the fun is asking questions I don't know the answer to. I own a business and I either fire or lay off or otherwise render somebody unemployed. Does that result in a direct cost to my business, or is the cost to my business already laid in according to how much revenue I'm bringing in?
So that'll be assessed, and then your rate will be adjusted on July 1st under normal circumstances. But what the Vermont Chamber advocated for a bill that was successfully passed in March of last year that sort of holds harmless, in a way, employers for their furloughs related to COVID-19, because we anticipated these mass furloughs occurring. Says to the Department of Labor, that these employers are not laying these people off because they're kind of a finicky business model. They're laying them off because of these tremendously unique circumstances, and really as a direct result of government mandates related to closures.
Sounds like go ahead.
Act 91 provided that. Act 91 is the piece of legislation that was advanced in March of last year, and it provided that for the duration of the pandemic and the executive emergency order.
Currently, the state of Vermont reported an unemployment rate of 3.5%. Before the pandemic started, it was around 2.5%. So we're really only looking at an increase of 1% in unemployment here in the state of Vermont. Is this a big problem here in the state to deal with this issue?
Yes, I would under normal circumstances, if we weren't in a pandemic, I think I could say with confidence that the Vermont Chambers, one of our biggest concerns would be our workforce shortage. Prior to the pandemic, this was a crisis. Because of the pandemic, it's more of a crisis. People have moved out of Vermont, but a lot of folks who are not going to be looking for jobs, once, you know, in the state of Vermont, once the restrictions are lifted. So this is certainly a problem. We have a workforce that is not sized adequately to address the overwhelming need in the employment community for workers.
It sounds like you're telling me that a lot of the people that are involved in the Chamber of Commerce, business owners and organizations, are finding a lack of people who can fill the positions that they need filled.
Yes, you know, absolutely. It's rare that I speak to a business, you know, throughout my week who doesn't mention that they have open positions and they're having a very hard time filling them. And these are not low-paying positions. You know, these are entry-level positions that are paying above $15 an hour with benefits, sometimes above $20 an hour with benefits, and they really cannot find folks to fill these positions.
I saw a recent report out, Charles, that said that the state of Vermont was ranked last in the country in the number of small businesses that were starting, but were toward the top of the rankings in the nations in terms of the number of businesses that were starting that were being able to operate successfully and sustainably. Any thoughts on how those two rankings can come into play, or what creates that atmosphere here in the state of Vermont?
Vermont is a wonderful place to have a business, but I think we know that there are challenges, especially in rural communities, with the viability of business models in some instances. There's a whole host of reasons for why that might be. That might require a longer period of time than we have today. But this is a paramount concern to the Vermont Chamber. We kind of explore what those reasons are, and we try to flush them out. And we also try to look at things in the legislature if we think that's going to add to problems that would discourage business startup or business growth in the state. I don't know that I could say exactly, why small businesses have such a hard time starting up in the state of Vermont. I will say, we have, like I said, some pretty serious challenges in terms of workforce and finding workforce, and also just some wider demographic challenges in the state that don't necessarily apply to workforce, but just, the population necessary to keep a business viable is certainly a concern for at least some locations in Vermont.
And we're now, initially, once upon a time, it was 15 days to flatten the curve, and now we're about 375 days into some economic restrictions imposed in the state. For last year, a lot of businesses were kind of grinding it out, but they're taking a lot of wear and tear, and it doesn't seem like this is the sort of situation that can continue indefinitely. Are you getting a lot of feedback from small business owners that they may be on the brink of folding up altogether?
Absolutely. That's a daily concern to our staff, and it's something we kind of wear on our shoulders because it's, our responsibility to advocate for a lot of these folks. We're kind of all they have in the legislative context and their engagement with the executive branch. The state of Vermont, the legislature and the Scott administration did a tremendous job advancing grants for businesses, small businesses, in particular over the summer and fall. We did successfully put a lot of money into those businesses to account for their economic losses that resulted as a result of the pandemic. But that only goes so far. And as you alluded to, it's been over a year now, and folks are not really positioned to do this indefinitely. And that's one of the reasons why we're continuing to encourage the legislature to prepare for additional grant programs that could be used to keep these businesses afloat to kind of get us through the remainder of these restrictions.
Does it feel like you're finding sympathetic ears in Montpelier right now to the plight, it seems to me like there's a conflict or a divide between the legislators who kind of want to do everything they can to ease the economic hardship on Vermonters who are struggling and sustaining businesses at all. Is there a battle between small business and low-income Vermonters for getting support in the legislature?
I don't think it's a combative sort of relationship. I think the majority of legislators have heard enough from people in their districts to understand that the crisis in the business community, the economic crisis, is real, and that the business community does need additional support. I don't know that there are too many legislators who would deny that fact. But as you alluded to, there's also other work going on in the legislature that's unrelated to COVID-19. At times, that can be kind of frustrating to see, given the crisis that we're in right now, sort of the imminent threats to Vermonters and Vermont businesses. We would really love to see a more direct focus on COVID-19-related matters. I think some advocates from some other circles try to do this sort of like workers versus businesses disposition, but the fact of the matter is I don't communicate with any business owners in our orbit who don't do everything they possibly can to provide their workers with high benefits and high pay and everything they need to live happy and healthy lives. So I would say it's not so combative from my perspective.
This bill we've been talking about here in Vermont Viewpoint this morning, S-10, the new benefit for the unemployment benefits is expected to cost anywhere from $12 to $21 million. And that was kind of a slide in during the 11th hour without any testimony. So how
– yeah.
If S-10 didn't have that slide in, would the Chamber of Commerce be more in favor of what else is in that bill?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think you're alluding to a beneficiary or a dependent stipend, which, you know, there's a time and a place to talk about that. You're correct that there was no opportunity provided for any advocates to weigh in on that, which is a little bit frustrating. But I would say, you know, that if we're going to talk about things like that, that time and place should be after the federal benefit expires in September, because this $300 weekly benefit that I alluded to in the beginning of our conversation expires in September. And so that might be a time where we could have those conversations. But right now, it's really the dependency benefit on top of the 20% increase amounts to a $50+ million drawdown to the UI fund. In a time where Vermont and Vermont businesses can't really afford it. And it's also just sort of unnecessary because we have this tremendous opportunity to kind of capitalize on what the feds are providing us right now. And there's not really a need to be duplicative and provide these additional incentives on top of the federal benefits, because that really puts folks in a position where they're absolutely incentivized to not return to work and to stay home and continue collecting their UI benefits at no fault to them. It's just logical behavior if you're presented with that scenario and you want to care for your family.
And small businesses, when you think if one small business goes under, it's not a big deal. But if that blankets out to a lot of different communities in the state of Vermont, small businesses account for about 60% of the state's workforce, and companies with 20 employees or less create the largest percentage of new jobs. So it might be a small business, but as a body, they are the driving force in helping Vermonters live and thrive.
No, you nailed it there. It's a symbiotic relationship. You know, we can talk about businesses and we can talk about workers and we can try to do that in isolation. But the fact of the matter is, workers need places to be employed for us to have viable communities in the state of Vermont, and businesses need their workers. And if these businesses and these small businesses continue to kind of close and be restricted and unable to operate at full capacity, that consequently means that workers will not have jobs.
We're talking with Charles Martin. He is the Government Affairs Director at the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. They are at vtchamber.com if you'd like to find out what the Vermont Chamber of Commerce is working on. You are invited to join in the conversation. We've got Charles with us for the hour. And if you'd like to be a part of the show, it's 244-1777 and toll-free from everywhere at 877-291-8255. And if you find out about this show and want to catch a piece of it that you missed, the Vermont Viewpoint podcast is available on our website at wdevradio.com. I'm Lee Cattell, filling in for Ricks and Gary today on Vermont Viewpoint. We'll head to the newsroom and take care of some of our own commerce, and then we'll be back with Charles Martin after this.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings, and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
The This is Vermont Viewpoint on Live and Local, WDEV FM and AM. I'm Lee Cattell, filling in for Rick Sengary today. Rick will be back tomorrow. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to tour Burlington with a Burlington historian, Gary DeCarolis. We'll talk about, we're going to go back hundreds of years through the history of the Queen City coming up in the next hour here on WDEV. With me right now is Charles Martin, the Government Affairs Director with the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. We spent the first half hour talking about S-10, which a lot of small business groups are lining up to discourage the legislators from passing with what they call a rather onerous additional cost to small business owners here in the state of Vermont. And Charles, I know you're working against it, but based on the support that it got in the committee, are you expecting this to be defeated, or what's the outlook right now for S-10?
Yeah, and, you know, I want to point out that S-10 does contain some very agreeable provisions, as we discussed earlier in the conversation. It does involve that sort of deferral of payment into the fund and pushes that out to later years. The employers have a little short-term liquidity right now. But as far as sort of the prospects of the bill advancing, it was supposed to be taken up yesterday and it was held over, which is an indication that there's a little bit of trepidation going on in the Senate about passing the bill. This is certainly the equivalent of reading the tea leaves, but I would say I expect the ultimate form of this bill to be somewhat different than it is drafted right now. It still has to go, even if it does pass the Senate in its current form, it still has to go through the House. I know there's a number of House legislators from all parties that have concerns about the bill and will probably suggest changes. So I would expect it to look a lot different when and if it does advance.
And it seems like how my, you know, far away view of the what's going on in the state house is there's a lot of haggling that goes on for a length of time, and then as you approach the end of the session, there's really three people in a room that sit around and decide what they ultimately do.
Yep, you nailed it. This bill will inevitably, I think, you know, go to conference. I believe the Senate will likely, if it does move this bill in its current form, it's going to pass a bill that will not be agreeable to the full House. So there is going to need to be a conference committee on this if that does in fact happen. And you know, I'll qualify all that by saying these are predictions, and I can't forecast the exact legislative future, but that's how I've seen these sort of things work in the past.
Charles, you recently testified in support of an economic development package in the House Committee on Commerce and Economic Development, and that package included funding to create a tourism marketing promotion fund. But I have to ask you, if we're in a period where travel and tourism is so severely restricted, should we wait until travel and tourism is more free before we even start to think about spending any money on an item like that?
No, that's a great question. The intent, and you know, we're fully supportive of that appropriation, and definitely happy with the work the House Commerce Committee has done on it. But the intent, you know, over the last several months, the state of Vermont, rightfully so, to keep us all safe, has kind of discouraged folks from coming here and made it not an unpleasant experience to come here, but certainly a more restricted experience with some kind of unfavorable interactions that, you know, checking in at your hotel looks a lot different today than it did a year and a half ago, for instance. So the intent of that funding is to say, you know, when it's appropriate, when it's safe, to say to out-of-staters in our kind of driving orbit, hey, we're open. We're open for business. We're safe to come here. We want to have you, and we're ready. We're ready to restart. You know, our region is all planning on doing the same. So we're in direct competition with our neighboring states in the Northeast. And Vermont, out of any of these states, and prior to the pandemic, invests. I think we're at just about the bottom in terms of our tourism marketing investment. So this would really be a meaningful way for the hospitality sector to advertise itself to potential guests And, you know, as you probably are aware, the hospitality sector was hardest hit by this pandemic and had to lay off the most workers and reduce their operations to the greatest extent.
We're talking with Charles Martin. He is the Vermont Chamber Government Affairs Director for the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. They're online at vtchamber.com. You are invited to join us on the phones at 244-1777 and toll-free from everywhere at 1-877-291-8255. And, Charles, looking at some of the other issues, that one of the another sort of small business niche in Vermont that has been growing is the short-term rental opportunities, where people are renting out places that maybe only have one or two spots in them and renting them out and doing a pretty good bit of economic business that way. The Chamber is supporting creating a statewide short-term rental registry. And tell me why you think that is a good idea.
Yeah, so we just want the state, and I think the pandemic kind of highlighted why this is an important thing to do. We'd like the state to kind of achieve a little bit more equity between the short-term rental market and our traditional B&B market. And we think the registry is a very modest step toward doing that. You know, there are all these other proposals kind of out there for how we should regulate short-term rentals. This is sort of the one bit of those proposals that we're definitely supportive of, and we've been supportive of for some time. This will allow the state to kind of know the scope of the short-term rental market in the state. It will allow communities to know the scope of those the short-term rental market in their towns, and we think it will be a meaningful way to kind of identify that sector more appropriately without overburdening them with, you know, unsustainable regulations.
Would this likely lead to an increase in taxation on people who rent out short-term rentals?
I don't necessarily, think so, that it has a direct conduit to that. It's just at this point, the state really doesn't have a full capture of who, how large and where these entities are, which is a bit, you know, concerning for a number of reasons from our perspective.
And is it, who's helping to drive this advocacy at the Vermont Chamber of Commerce? Is it larger hotel and motel businesses, or is it smaller bed and breakfasts?
Smaller bed and breakfasts, because they're about this, you know, they look very similar to a short-term rental, and those smaller bed and breakfast entities are kind of in a position where they have to comply with a whole kind of scope of regulatory frameworks that these short-term rental operations do not have to adhere to.
Can you explain to me what is going on with people who rent out short-term right now that merits them needing greater regulation?
And, you know, I want to be clear that we're not advocating for a tranche of regulatory burdens to fall onto short-term rental operators. We would just like to understand the size of the market. It helps with economic planning. It helps with marketing. It helps with just sort of identifying the significance of short-term rental markets in terms of their relationship to housing, different communities. And that's kind of the perspective that we're coming at that from.
Okay, well, I understand all that, but I also understand that once they're all registered and put under a body, then once you are part of that registry, then regulations can begin to be applied.
I mean, in theory, that's definitely correct. And I think, you know, for instance, with the pandemic, that would have helped the state to identify who was coming to these lodging operations and who was staying there. And it would have been beneficial from a public health standpoint throughout the pandemic, because there was really not a reliable data capture of the size of the market.
That's S-79, the creation of the statewide short-term rental registry. What are your thoughts on the likely success or failure of that bill this year?
It has momentum. I think it will advance to the Senate and probably receive a considerable amount of support in the House. I don't know that there's too many people who are adamantly opposed to a registry. I think there are folks who are opposed to expanding regulations beyond that at this point. But that's kind of where it is right now in the legislature.
There recently was a short-term rental association group created that's got about 500 of those business owners here in Vermont. Have you had any contact with them, and are they in support of this registry as well?
I haven't personally had contact with them. Amy Spear, I pointed out earlier in our conversation, our vice president of tourism, engages the hospitality sector on a daily basis, and I'm sure Amy has spoken with that group in the past. I don't know their exact perspective on a registry at this point. I haven't spoken with any advocates from that group.
We're talking with Charles Martin. He is the Government Affairs Director with the Vermont Chamber of Commerce on some of the legislative bills that are affecting business and commerce here in the state of Vermont. Vermont is to the consternation of many older people in the state, and there are a lot of older persons here in Vermont. One of the few states that tax retirement pay, and that includes military retirement pay. And the Vermont Chamber is looking at a possible tax exemption proposal for military retirement pay.
That's correct. You know, we've been supportive of this proposal for a few years now, and, you know, there's a number of reasons why we support it. There's sort of this, it's the right thing to do, patriotic element to it, which is certainly present in our minds. But when you look at the military retiree population, they're generally high-skilled. They're a vetted employee who has successfully served their country for at least 20 years under very high standards. And they typically retire in their 40s with a bunch of certifications, a family, and they're looking for a place to kind of call home for the rest of their lives. And we talked about workforce shortages earlier on in this conversation. They would be the exact kind of worker that we would like to see come to Vermont. They are high-skilled and ready to go to work and reliable and ready to start new careers. There's another element to this that's kind of, you know, not emerged this year but been highlighted this year. A number of legislators are discussing sort of the lack of diversity in our communities. 43% of the military as a population that could be described as non-white, and bringing that population and incenting them to come to the state of Vermont would also add to the diversity element that legislators in the Vermont Chamber are certainly supportive of.
So skilled people, plus they already have one form of income coming in, and even though you don't tax that money, if this bill were passed, the money would not be taxed as it comes in, but it would be taxed in other ways as it was spent. Plus the possibility of these people generating revenue in other manners, plus the skills that they bring into the state, and bringing in some of those retirement benefits as well. That sounds like a pretty good idea. What's the response been in the legislature about that?
You know, it's a win-win for the state. It's not a lot of money that we have to account for in the short term. And I'll also add their kids will go to our schools and help with some of our more rural school districts' problems with low pupil rates. The legislature, there's a National Guard caucus right now that is helping to shepherd this legislation along. But I would say the major resistance is in the House Ways and Means Committee. That committee has kind of said no to this for the last few years. It's been a challenge to get that bill through that committee, and that is really one of the hurdles that we need to overcome to advance it. The wider legislature, there's bipartisan support for this proposal. I think people realize it makes economic sense, and it would provide a reliable return on investment for Vermont if we were to do this.
So Ways and Means is basically looking at short-term cash as opposed to the longer range, and they don't see that this money that's taxed as income could be regained back through how it was spent, through sales tax and other things that it was used for?
I think you kind of captured it accurately. They're not convinced that we will reacquire those funds in other ways. I think that's, like you said, kind of short-term thinking. I'm confident that if we were to lift this, folks from installations around the country would be far more incented to move to Vermont and contribute to our communities. And, you know, these are service-oriented people. These are folks who will join our fire departments. They're people with emergency services skills. They're highly skilled workers. And as I said, they have families that will go into our schools, and they'll certainly contribute to our economy in a whole host of other ways.
And those areas where you think they might contribute are also areas that a lot of people are saying there is a shortage of help in.
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've raised that point with a number of legislators. But as I said, you know, the House Ways and Means Committee has been the major sticking point on this issue for the last few years. We'd certainly like to find a way to get it through that committee, but the committee has been so far kind of resistant to our proposals.
Charles, the state made an effort at the start of the pandemic to house homeless people in motels. What are you hearing from people in the motel industry about how this program has affected their business?
You know, I'd love to comment on that, but I really haven't personally spoken on that exact issue with any of our hoteliers or moteliers. So I haven't heard much on it, to be completely frank.
All right. Well, I love somebody who's honest enough with me to give me an answer that they don't know something. So thank you for that. Let's spend a minute, though, talking about a popular topic of conversation, alcohol consumption. With the pandemic coming in, curbside service and people being able to pick up drinks and take them home with them, which for a long time was absolutely taboo here in Vermont, is now been acceptable. And the Vermont Chamber has some opinions on the policies about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we're supportive of H313, which would extend, sort of place a sunset, but extend alcohol to go for our restaurants. You know, that's been a really meaningful source of revenue for struggling restaurants, and we'd like to see it continue. So far, I don't think there's been public health data that would allude to there being any significant problems with alcohol to go. It's just sort of one small thing that the state can do to kind of help out a industry that's in a bit of trouble right now.
So when you say sunset, it's going to is it going to end when the state of emergency ends, or what's the timeline on that? And is this something that we would like to extend indefinitely?
So under this legislation, currently it would end when the state emergency was over. Under this legislation, it would extend through July 1st, 2023. This would allow, you know, restaurants who have purchased inventory for to-go operations to kind of clear out that inventory and wind down and explain to their customer bases that they're no longer doing this, because at this point there's sort of an expectation that this service will be provided, and we don't want to just halt that too suddenly.
Also, some licenses have to purchase wholesale spirits, and they can't use a credit card. Why is that the case?
You know, I think I would. I think you need to bring on the Department of Liquor and Lottery to go into that in detail. It's certainly a frustrating element for us at the Vermont Chamber, and we're advocating for use of credit cards for the purchase of wholesale liquor as well.
So basically, it's checker. It's checker cash right now. If they're going to buy from the Vermont Liquor Authority,
correct.
Okay. Yeah. I've got only about 2 minutes left, Charles. Please tell me one other significant issue that the Vermont Chamber of Commerce is working on with the legislators this year.
Yeah, so we're, I think another piece of legislation that folks should be concerned with is we're supporting what's being called gap recovery funding. It's a grant program included in the legislature's COVID-19 relief bill, H-315, that would provide an additional $10 million in potential grant funds for business entities who were left behind by previous grant programs. These are just people who may have started a business and they weren't able to access grant funds because they didn't start the business in time to be able to compare past year taxes to current year taxes, or their sole proprietor, or a whole host of other reasons. This funding, it's not a huge amount of funds, but it would certainly be a meaningful program for those businesses that were unable to access significant grant relief under the past programs. That's currently being considered in the Senate Economics Committee. I know there are some proposed amendments to it right now, but we're hoping that advances largely as designed by the House, because it really could serve a portion of our business community who desperately needs those funds.
And that's H315. And you can find the text of some of these bills at Vermont Chamber of Commerce website, vtchamber.com. And this, we're talking with Charles Martin, the Government Affairs Director with the Vermont Chamber. Mr. Martin, I very much appreciate you giving us an hour here on Vermont Viewpoint this morning. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
We head toward the top of the hour here on WDEV FM and AM. We'll get the latest in world and national news. When we return, we're going to tour Burlington. Gary DeCarolis of Burlington History Tours will join us and chronicle the history of the Queen City on Vermont Viewpoint, right here on these incredible stations.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
WDEV broadcasts live from our studios here in Waterbury, Vermont, every single day, as we have been since 1931. I'm Lee Cattell, filling in for Ricks and Gary on Vermont Viewpoint this morning, and we're going to go from Waterbury to Burlington today and get some exciting and entertaining details about Vermont's largest city, Burlington, Vermont. Joining me is Gary DeCarolis of Burlington History Tours to go back in time and find out more about the history of Burlington. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Lee. Glad to be here. Thank you.
How far back in history do you go when you talk about the history of Burlington? Do we get into like the Mesozoic era, or are we a little bit more contemporary than that?
Well, I've given lectures on the history of Lake Champlain, which does go way, way back. But for Burlington, what I usually start off with is to talk about the Iroquois and Algonquin nations that were here before us Euro-Americans arrived.
You mentioned two nations. So were they adversaries or colleagues? And what was the relationship between those two tribes? Were they operating during the same time in the same area?
Yeah, that great question. So they were adversaries to a degree, but I think lived in different parts of the area. So they kind of got along because that was an okay thing to do. But you had the Iroquois Nation, which basically is south and west of Burlington, south going all the way down to New York City, and then west all the way out to Buffalo. And Seneca, Onondaga, Oneida, Cayuga, and Mohawk tribes were part of that. Then the Algonquin Nation, which would be north up into Canada and east all the way to Maine, and that's where Abnaki, Huron, and Montagnes tribes were part of that. Where things got a little difficult and where war broke out is after Samuel D. Champlain arrived in 1609. He comes up Lake Champlain and with about 30 Huron Indians and heads south on the lake, about 30 miles south of Burlington, engages with the Iroquois. And on that day in 1609, he ended up shooting a couple and killing a couple tribal chiefs. Now, this was the first time guns had ever been introduced into this area at all, so this was a shock to the Iroquois Nation. Well, Champlain came and left, and he kept a diary during his time here, so we know a lot of what happened based on his diary. What he didn't realize, though, is because of what happened that day, the Iroquois Nation was furious with the Algonquin Nation because they had come with Champlain. So the Iroquois go to out to the English, get guns. The Algonquins, their way of getting guns was to convert to Catholicism. So while the Algonquins are trying to figure out what is this thing called Catholicism, the Iroquois are loading up on ammunition and guns and literally started 150 years of warfare between these two Indian nations. Eventually
what?
Leading... Yeah.
No, go ahead. Keep going.
Well, the last part, eventually leading to the French and Indian War. And you had the English to the south, the French to the north, the Algonquins siding with the French, the Iroquois siding with the British. Of course, the British won that war and ended up, you know, pushing the French up into Canada at that point.
What do we know about that initial confrontation? Was there a provocation, or do we have much on the history of that initial contact?
Well, because of Champlain's diaries, we have, there's a little rock outside of Burlington Harbor here. We call it Rock Dunder. Abnaki would call it Otsihozo. But once you cross over that rock, if you're on the lake, you go from Algonquin to Iroquois territory. So Champlain went over that rock. He knew he was in, for the Hurons who were with him, enemy territory. So when that engagement happened, more than just the killing of the two chiefs, there was a lot of prisoners taken, and all those prisoners were put to death by the Hurons. And at one point, they actually asked Champlain if he would join in, and he was horrified at what was happening. And he said, the only way I'll join in is if you let me shoot them dead. And he did. He ended up killing a number of Iroquois Nation Indians that day. This is all part of it. Now, once either tribe, either nation, if you were captured, you pretty much knew your fate in life. It didn't matter if you were male, female, old, young. That was just what happened. And again, all this detailed in his journals.
So DeChamplain's involvement in that shooting was as part of for the captives was essentially a mercy killing to save them from a more painful death?
Exactly. Absolutely. Huh. You got it. Things would happen like gouging of the eyes, dismemberment, all kinds of pretty horrific tortures that from what we would know as inhumane today went on. So he was witness to all that and just He just couldn't stand it. So that's where he asked if he could just shoot them dead. And many times they would bring you close to death and then bring you back a little bit, give you water, start to put some, medication on your wounds, and then they'd kick you further. Oh. So it was not a quick exit, so to speak.
Was this in DeChamplain's first effort to come into the Burlington area?
That's right. First and only in 1609. He only was here once in the lake. Most of his time was up north, and then he explored further west from the St. Lawrence River. But this was his only time coming up Lake Champlain.
Well, my favorite Samuel D. Champlain story may not even be true, but I'll share it anyway, because my understanding is that the name Lamoille County, is a mistranscription of some notes that he took while he was going up that Lamoille River. It was called Lamouette, because Lamouette is French for a place for birds to land. And the person who transcribed his notes didn't cross his T, so the two T's became two L's, and hence Lamouette became Lamoille, which is a word that has no meaning in French.
Interesting. Hmm. Well, I didn't know that. That's great.
Well, you've got the Burlington history covered, and I've got Lamoille, so there we go.
Okay, there we go.
So what's – now that we know that – the lake bears Samuel D. Champlain's name. What do you think is the most interesting thing on the bottom of that lake?
Oh, my goodness. There's, you know, the Maritime Museum here has wonderfully cataloged much of it. There's literally 300 ships and boats of different variety at the bottom of the lake. And by the way, the lake, this lake is as much as 400 feet deep in places. Of course, it's 120 miles long, flows north into the Richelieu River. But, yeah, so there's all kinds of, you know, they've brought up one ship from when Benedict Arnold was defeated in the Battle of Balfour Island, and that sits in the Smithsonian Museum, and they're about ready to bring up a second ship called the Spitfire and try to put that back together again over on the New York side. But so there's, gosh, there's all kinds of wonderful ships down there. It's a museum in and of itself.
Well,
one of the great stories. Yeah, go on.
Go, no, if you got a great story, I'd rather hear that.
I have a great story, and I think it's a very visual, so you have to visualize this. But the first Euro-American resident of Burlington was a guy named Felix Powell. He put a log cabin up on Apple Tree Point in Burlington, okay? And that's in 1773. So, of course, in 1775, on May 10th, Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys took over Fort Ticonderoga from the British, right, without killing anyone, roughing up the sentry at the front maybe a little bit. Well, the British weren't happy with that. They had lost their crown jewel of the West at that time. George Washington was very happy because we won the crown jewel of the West. So the British were doing everything they could to come back and take that over. So in 1777, so that's 4 years after Ethan Allen took over the fort, the British bring over General Burgoyne from England to Montreal. He puts together an 8,000-member armada, 8,000-member men, and 643 boats. And they come up the lake. So you can imagine Felix Powell's there in his log cabin right on the lake, and he looks to the north and sees 643 boats, three warships and 640 longboats and bateaux. Now, if you can imagine seeing on Lake Champlain, or any lake for that matter, 643 boats, all with British flags flying, well, Felix Powell packed up his bags and got out of there soon after. He sold that land. It was not a safe place to live at this point because the French, the British were going back and forth. The Iroquois, Algonquin nations still existed. But I think visually, that's probably one of the most fascinating things that happened early in Burlington's history. I would love to recreate that on the lake. It must have been an amazing sight to see and probably scared the bejesus out of them.
Right. Company's coming. Time to get out of Dodge.
Right.
So from the moment that a European settler came into the area with Samuel D. Champlain, that brought immediately with it the start of gunfire here in the Green Mountains. And then once the Revolutionary War got underway, was Burlington a strategic point at any point during that conflict?
It's a good question. Not so much. It was, you know, as I said, Burgoyne came by the city. Well, there was no city at that point, but he came by this area. You know, most of it happened in the Fort Ticonderoga, Crown Point area. That was certainly significant, but not so much in this area here. War of 1812, a little different, for sure.
I can certainly talk
to you about that as well, if you'd like.
The War of 1812. Yeah, go ahead, because Lake Champlain is an interesting location because you can actually get to a lot of different points through the North American waterways from this lake.
Absolutely. In fact, always from the north side. So Lake Champlain flowing into the Richelieu River flows into the St. Lawrence. So we've always had access to the Atlantic Ocean through the north. But after 1823, we built canals on the southern part of the lake that hook up with the Hudson. Of course, the Hudson goes out to the Atlantic as well. So on both ends of our lake, you literally, you could go around the world by boat and come back home, which it's an amazing feature. So in the War of 1812, actually in 1813, on August 2nd, it's something called Murray's Raid happened. Three British warships anchored off of our bay, and there was a cannon exchange between the British and us. We had cannon lined up along the perimeter of Battery Park in Burlington. Also at the time, there were 4,000 soldiers that wrapped around Battery Park. This was the northern jump-off point for our military forces. So I'm sure the British were interested in trying to take care of that a little bit. There was a hospital that ran right along the middle of Battery Park. And in 1813, there was a smallpox and pneumonia epidemic that happened. And a lot of these soldiers were quickly buried in the woods to the north of Battery Park, which today is the old north end of Burlington. And when the city has put, for example, on North Street, they put wires underneath the road, they bumped into a lot of these unmarked grave sites. And because of the smallpox, they were buried very quickly without markers. When those soldiers, when we bump up against those grave sites, and there's probably some 300 soldiers buried in the old North End that most have not been bumped into or dug into, they're reinterred up in Lakeview Cemetery. While that cannon exchange happened, and there was no one killed during that exchange, the British eventually went into Shelburne Bay, where there was a shipbuilding facility, and burnt a few ships there, and then headed back north up to Plattsburgh. The commander of our naval forces there, was Commander McDonald, was in the bay at the time. And he was just starting to put our Navy together for this war. Eventually, he goes up to Plattsburgh, and the Battle of Plattsburgh is a pretty infamous turning point in battle of the War of 1812. We had smaller ships, and we had less ships than the British. But on that day, he did something strategically that was very significant. So the British come into the Plattsburgh Bay there, Cumberland Bay, from the north, and they turn into the bay. Well, and then the cannon exchange happens between the U.S. and Britain. About halfway through the battle, McDonald says to his captains, "Release one of your anchors." So all the ships turned 180 degrees. They had a fresh side with fresh cannon, and they started blasting away again at the British and were able to defeat the British because of that maneuver, where the British were all shooting from one side of their ships. We were able to use both sides of the ships and beat them. So that was a pretty and he went on. Because of that great notoriety, it went on to a very distinguished career in the Navy.
Gary, the university is one of the premier features of the contemporary Burlington. And at the founding of a lot of universities, like Harvard University and a lot of the prestigious universities in New England were created for the purpose of teaching Christian doctrine to people who wanted to become preachers. What was the University of Vermont founded for or with in mind?
Well, that's a great question, Lee. So the University of Vermont was founded in 1791. The land for the university was given by Ira Allen and the Allen brothers, Ethan, Ira, and there's a number of other brothers as well, but they own most of Burlington today at that time. And Ira had this vision of not only starting the University of Vermont, but he wanted to start a number of academic institutions throughout the state. It was very important to him to do that. He never was able to realize all that. He had his own problems that got in the way. But that's a whole other story. We could do something on Ira Allen for the whole hour. But anyhow, it was his vision that started the university. The first building didn't happen until 10 years later, 1801, and Ira Allen supplied many of the bricks for that building, or many of the supplies for that building. That was a wood-frame building in 1801. There's a home on Battery Street where Dr. Pomeroy lived, right? Lower Battery between Main Street and King Street. You can see it. It's on the east side of the street. Well, anyhow, Dr. Pomeroy was the first faculty member for the medical school at the University of Vermont. And because the first building for the medical school didn't happen until later, he taught first medical school classes out of this house down on Battery Street, which was called Water Street at the time. Many of the first presidents of the University of Vermont were ministers. So what you're saying is probably very accurate as well.
Also, regarding what goes on in Burlington, I was checking out your website, and it says, learn what Queen Victoria, the movie Glory, General Lafayette, Howard University, Ben and Jerry's, and the first cross-country automobile ride have in common.
They all happened in Burlington.
They did all happen in Burlington.
Yeah.
Well, the movie Glory, what, filmed or written or what?
No, some of the soldiers that this was the Glory. It has to do with a black troop in the Civil War that was put together, and at least four of those soldiers are buried in Lakeview Cemetery. One of the commanding officers from that time for that troop actually is buried in the Lakeview Cemetery, and these soldiers wanted to be buried near him. So, yes, so there's that. Let's see, I don't have my website in front of me, but there's a number of others. Of course, the Ben and Jerry started in Burlington, Vermont, down on the corner of College and St. Paul Street in an old gas station.
I know, that's right. From humble beginnings, the ice cream monster was created.
Absolutely. Yep. And I so wish that they had preserved that building because it would be pretty famous. But there are pictures and postcards, and you go to Waterbury, you can see all that at the factory.
That's right. It would probably be housing an ice cream museum as we speak.
Yes. Now, go on.
I was just going to say, you know, that's interesting, those soldiers from the movie Glory, that's from a Massachusetts regiment of all-black soldiers fighting for the North in the Civil War, and in a rather ill-fated attack that they had. That was part of what the movie was featured on, but it's nice to know. From the movie, you didn't think there were many survivors of that incident. I'm glad to know that some of them made it back here to the Green Mountains.
Yes. Yes. Now, in that same cemetery, there's a general buried there named Oliver Otis Howard, and who actually wasn't born in Burlington. He was born in Maine, and he fought in many of the significant battles of the Civil War. And as the war was winding down, actually Sherman was doing this, his march to the sea, and Oliver Otis Howard was with him. He gets a call, or gets notified, no phone calls in those days, gets notified that Abraham Lincoln wants him to come up to Washington. And the idea was for having him take over this new bureau that had just been created to, and it was to oversee the freed slaves that were about to happen. Well, Lincoln was shot between when Oliver Otis Howard was notified and when he got to Washington. But the Secretary of War, Stanton, carried out Lincoln's wish and offered this job to head this bureau to Oliver Otis Howard. Now, and the idea was to take care of their housing, legal.
Gary, we're going to have to hold on for just a moment. I have a hard break coming up here, but we'll continue this story about Mr. Howard as we continue on Vermont Viewpoint here on WDEV FM and AM.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV FM and AM. Lee Cattell filling in for Ricks and Gary today. He'll be back tomorrow. Gary DeCarolis is the operator of Burlington History Tours. And Gary, when we went into the break, you were telling us about Oliver Howard, who had been tabbed by President Lincoln to run a freed slave program after the Civil War.
Yes. So it's called the Freedmen's Bureau. And Congress had just passed this. And, of course, Lincoln wanted Howard to run this. So he's coming up to D.C. to talk to the president. The president gets assassinated, and Secretary Stanton, Secretary of War, carries out Lincoln's wish and offers Howard the job. And he says, I'll give you 24 hours to make a decision. Well, it was a no-brainer for Oliver Otis Howard. He absolutely accepted the job, and he was the only commissioner of this Freedmen's Bureau during its 9-year existence. And the basic job of the Bureau was to take care of the housing, educational, legal, and general welfare of the freed slaves, 4.5 million freed slaves. So one of the things that Howard did was to start what we call today the traditionally black schools across the South, one of them being Howard University. In fact, he was the first president of Howard University in D.C., and the school is named after Oliver Otis Howard. So I was curious about, well, what did Lincoln see in this particular general that he wanted to give him this prominent position? And so Oliver Otis Howard wrote a 2-volume autobiography, great, great biography. He loved history of the Civil War and this is a wonderful book to read. Well, in the book, Oliver Otis Howard mentions that his father, on one of his business trips, brings home a 7-year-old African-American young boy. And they became brothers, basically. And Oliver Otis Howard attributes his ability to go beyond the prejudices and racism of the day because of his brother. He lived with him. He did everything with him. And he became a staunch advocate for African Americans in his work as a general and as a private citizen. In fact, he was in a religious community in D.C. that would not allow African Americans in it, and he left that and started another Christian congregation that did allow African Americans. And so he was very. Is an outspoken advocate for the African-American. Another great story with that, and then we'll leave Oliver for a bit, and I'll tell you why he came to Burlington a little bit later. So this landowner in D.C. wanted to sell his land, but apparently there were hundreds of African-Americans living on the land at the time. This is in Washington, D.C. So he asked Oliver Otis Howard to help him. So Howard says, well, let me come down and talk to people and see what's going on. What do they want? And they said, all we want is some land to grow crops and to build our homes on. He says, okay. He buys a large tract of land up in southeast D.C., and he says, that's your land. You go up there, build your homes, grow your crops. It's yours. Now, he got money. He never was given an appropriation from Congress. All the money that he got to do what he needed to do was from the sale of plantations in the South after the war. And so today, the southeast part of D.C. is a traditionally black part of Washington, D.C. And it's that way in part because of Oliver Otis Howard and what he did back then. So how did he get to Burlington? His son was stationed at 40th and Allen in Colchester later in his years after Oliver Otis Howard retired from the service. And he and his wife wanted to be close to his son. So they bought a home in Burlington. And while living in that home, he wrote some 6 books, including that 2-volume autobiography, and dies in Burlington and is buried in Lakeview Cemetery in the city.
We're talking with Gary DeCarolis. He is with Burlington History Tours, and you are invited at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Fred from Newberry on the line. Go ahead, Fred.
Oh, my question is a general question about warfare. And if you look at it, warfare became far more predominant after sedentary farming became widespread. And I believe the reason was sedentary farming made the land in the areas a lot more valuable. So if you look at warfare from then on, it's always been about natural resources. World War II was a natural resources war. World War I was. And basically, the Civil War, if you look at the Civil War, that was a natural resources war, and so was the American Revolution. The British didn't want to lose the natural resources in North America.
All right. Go ahead there, Gary. Any thoughts on that?
No, not really. I mean, I appreciate the thoughts.
All right. Thanks for the call, yeah. Fred. I get it. Although agriculture leading to military confrontation, maybe. There's all sorts of reasons why people can get into war with each other. But we've covered a lot of war, actually, and Burlington's ordinarily a peaceful town, although politically it's been a hotbed here and there, and that's where I want to turn next, because, Gary, contemporary Burlington is a pretty hard left town with there's not a Republican in the city council. It's all progressives and Democrats, and has been a very left town for a while. How far back do we go before there was a more balance in Burlington?
Well, that's a great question. You know, Burlington has a history of being a progressive community, and I don't know exactly why when I think of way back, but there was a Mayor Burke. Mayor Burke was a very liberal Democrat. We have our own public electric department in part because of Mayor Burke. The Burlington Electric Department is its own public entity, and it's so we have had a history going. This is, you know, Mayor Burke was early 20th century. We're talking early 1900s. When I was on the city council in 1982 to 1988, and at that time there still was a Republican Party. We had a number of city councilors who were Republican at that point, but the Democratic Party had been in control of the city for a long time. And I think partly why the progressives were able to come into play is that they were it was a one-party city. It was a Democratic Party controlled the city council and the mayor's seat. And I think became very conservative, the Democrats. And so it left an opening for more progressive thinking people to, and Bernie captured that in 1981. And then it's been that way from that point on.
We're with Gary DeCarlis here on WDEV. He's with Burlington History Tours, 244-1777. Michelle from Plainfield, you're on Vermont Viewpoint. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to put a, since it's sort of, the theme is history, I wanted to put a plug in, and Gary could maybe talk about this a little if he knows, that Mount Independence, which is part of the Civil War, the Revolutionary War story, is just a wonderful museum. I was dazzled by it. It tells it from the British point of view. It tells it from the American point of view. And then there are beautiful walks where you get a feel for what you just heard about in the museum. So if anyone's looking for an outing with, like, I think kids like 8 years old to 10, I mean, we went as adults and we just were dazzled by it, the museum and the walks. So that's what I wanted to share.
Thanks for the call, Michelle. Where's the Mount Independence Museum, Gary?
It's right close to Fort Ticonderoga. It's on the Vermont side of Fort Ticonderoga, and was originally a strategic place to protect the lake from any encroaching British at the time, because we had taken over that fort. So, absolutely wonderful.
Thanks for the call, Michelle. Appreciate it. 244-1777 if you'd like to join us as we chat with Gary. As you take people on these Burlington history tours, of course, you'd been doing this for a while, and this past year everybody had to do things that they do differently.
Right. Yeah, so I've had to suspend all my actual tours. Last week I did a virtual tour, which in a sense is what we're doing today, for the University of Vermont, the OLLI program. And it's been sad. My van sits out front, and we haven't been able to do much. But I'm hoping to open up walking tours June 1st, which will be a wonderful thing. I've had a lot of people inquire about when we could start doing this again. I think I'll leave my van aside for another year and wait till things get better, back to normal, before I do that. It's an inside thing. But we'll start walking tours on June 1st and use the whole downtown is where the village started. So there's a lot of history right there that I can talk about.
Well, as we go virtually through your tour this morning, how about taking us to one of your favorite stops on the way?
Yeah, a couple things I think you'll find interesting. Let's talk about that, and I mentioned it earlier, what people call Rock Dunder. Off this out in Burlington Bay between Juniper Island and Shelburne Point. And for the Abnaki tribe, it's a very spiritual home there. And it's Otsiozo is what it's, the creator spirit is what it's called. And so the legend behind Otsiozo is that he was a half-made man, waist up. He spread his arms north and south and created what we call Lake Champlain, and then east and west, and created what we call the Adirondacks and the Green Mountains to the east. And he was so taken with what he had done that, and it was so beautiful that he became one with that rock. And there he sits today. Now, centuries later, a guy named Peter Toth in 1976 decided that he was going to carve a Native American figure in each of the 50 states in this country. Well, he got to Burlington in 1984 in Battery Park. You'll see a carving of Chief Greylock, who was an Abnaki chief, famous for his ability to skirmish with the British and colonials and get away without any problem. This was the 47th of 50 carvings. It came in 1984, Peter Toth. Some people might actually remember him carving that Chief Greylock right on Battery Park. But anyhow, so, and he put it there because of Otsiozo out in the bay. Later, during the Revolutionary War and the Battle of Valcour Island, which Benedict Arnold and our Navy got pretty roughed up by the British, whatever remained of our ships, Benedict Arnold was able to sneak out at night when everything quieted down with the remaining ships and head south. Well, this was in mid-October, and if you know the lake in October, you have cold air and warm water, so you get a lot of morning fog. You can still, today, if you went in October, you come by the lake, you'll still see that. Well, the British, when they woke up the next morning and saw that Benedict Arnold was gone, they start to chase after him. They head south. They think they have him cornered. They start cannonballing his ship, only to realize what they were shooting at was not his boat, but was Ocioso. And one of the British commanders says, "Oh, by dunder," meaning, "Oh, how stupid." And that's how that you know, people know that rock today, many of them, as Rock Dunder. And it's based on that episode. Now, when I was on the city council, I had more than one person come up to me and say that they actually dove down and pulled up cannonballs from underneath there. It's about 60 feet deep right there. Anyhow, so that's an interesting story of Ocioso and Rock Dunder. Another interesting thing that I think, you know, and it speaks to how if you're the second of anything, no one remembers you. The first steamboat was built by someone named Robert Fulton on the Hudson River in 1807. Now, we're talking about the first steamboat in the world.
Right.
The second steamboat in the world was built in Burlington by a guy named John Winnan, who actually helped Robert Fulton build that ship, right in Burlington. If people remember the Ice House restaurant down on Battery Street, well, that was John Winnan's home at one point, and he built that ship right behind his house. He was a shipbuilder. Went on to build many ships from that. But who knows John Winnan? Nobody. Many people know Robert Fulton.
Well, that's funny. And, you know, when you make the second one, you might be able to recognize some of the mistakes that were made in the first edition. So sometimes the second time around, you get a better version.
Absolutely. I would agree with you.
So when you give a tour of the city, a lot of times when you... I think of, like, Beverly Hills tours where you find all these famous people where they live or where they used to live. How many famous people are there that were born in Burlington?
Well, you know, we could probably debate about what famous means. They were famous in their time. They might not be famous today. But there's a number of people that are significantly larger than you would think are found in a small city as like we are of Burlington, Vermont. You know, I can think of, for example, a gentleman named George Perkins Marsh, lived in Burlington and wrote a book called Man and Nature back in the 1860s. Well, at the time, that was a environmentalist call of concern about how we were handling our natural environment. He grew up in Woodstock before he moved to Burlington and saw the clear cutting of Mount Tom in Woodstock and the erosion and the second growth trees not as strong and healthy as the original one. So he lived in Burlington. He went on to become the ambassador to Italy, appointed by Abraham Lincoln. He served over 30 years in that position, actually died in Italy. A good friend of his was Frederick Billings, you know, Billings Library up at the University of Vermont.
Sure.
Well, Frederick Billings was the CEO of the Northern Pacific Railway. At the time, that was a big deal. And as a former graduate of the University of Vermont and close friends to George Perkins Marsh, because they were both from Woodstock originally, as George Perkins Marsh was about ready to die, he asked if Frederick Billings, if he would buy his books. He was a prolific writer, George Perkins Marsh. Billings did and went to the university and said, if you have the land, I would like to build a library and house all of George Perkins Marshall's writings in the library. So the university says, you got the money, we got the land, let's do it. So in 1885, Billings Library opens up, and there's a special wing still there today of all of George Perkins Marshall's writings.
Talking with Gary DeCurlis of Burlington History Tours. Let's go to the phones. Gary from Barrie, you're on WDEV. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Hey, I might have missed it, but my question is, what did the Native Americans call the Lake Champlain?
Ooh, good question. That I don't know. That's a good question. Thank you.
All right. Gary, you stumped the guest, so thanks for the call. 96.5 is where you can hear us there at WDEV. We've got about 3 minutes left here. I interrupted you in mid-story before we went into the last break, Gary. What else did you want to discuss about? What are we going to that break with? Dunder Island.
Yeah, so Rock Dunder. And then we were talking about Frederick Billings and famous people. We've got probably just a little bit of time, but another famous person in his day was Timothy Follett. So people might know the building that he had built, which is the Pomelo Real Estate Building on College Street. Beautiful building that sits there today. That house was built in 1840. It was designed by Ami Young, another famous person in his day. He's an architect. Ami Young went on to design the state of Vermont's second state house. We're on our third state house right now. His protege designed the third one, but the front portico of Ami Young's state house remains. The state house burnt down. And so that's why we're on our third right now. But that house in 1840 cost a grand total of $25,000. Timothy Follett ran a forwarding house. And what that means is it was the middleman between the lake and the land. People would bring their goods to the lake, put them in his forwarding house, and then the ships would come in and take things out, and ships would bring things in to his forwarding house, and then bring it into the interior.
Sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry, Gary. Listen, I've got just a few moments left here, so talk a little bit about what you would provide in a tour right now, or what you're available to do for our listening audience.
Sure. Well, the tour is, I think one of the nice things about a tour with me is that you can ask any question you want. And like the gentleman who asked about the name of Lake Champlain by the Abnakis, if I don't know it, and I get stumped once in a while, I'll research it and get back to you. But it's a nice give and take. I'll tell some stories. People have questions. We walk through downtown area. It's a fun couple hours together. And I think you'll come away from it, even if you've lived in Burlington all of your life, I guarantee I can teach you something new about the city.
More at BurlingtonHistoryTours.com. Gary DeCurlis, thanks very much. We are out of time as we head to the top of the hour. Thanks for joining us, everybody. The Common Sense Radio program is next here on Vermont's news station, WDEV.